It's always a great thrill to talk with my friend Tom Franks, best-selling and award-winning author. And his books include Pity the Billionaire, The Wrecking Crew, and What's the Matter with Kansas? He's a former columnist for the Wall Street Journal and Harper's, the founding editor of The Baffler, and he writes regularly for Salon. His most recent book is Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Thomas Frank, welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, Coy. It's great to be here.
Thank you for making time, Tom. I really appreciate it, especially on a holiday. So I want to talk about this book, but before we do, before we really delve into, we want to say at the outset that this is, your book really is, it's the stone cold truth that that many liberals and progressives just don't want to talk about. It's, there really isn't a lot of self-reflection and critical thinking. There's such a team mentality that, well, this is our team, love it or leave it. And you are really holding up a mirror to the Democratic Party and saying, look, this is what you've become, and it ain't pretty.
Yeah, well, that's very nice of you to put it that way. That's exactly what I was aiming for. And I was surprised when I wrote it, and am surprised now the book is out there, at how little self-reflection, you know, how little self-understanding there is among liberals. You know, they come up with these endless theories about conservatives. I myself do this, right? I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas and The Wrecking Crew. That's me. I wrote that. But they aren't willing to speculate, you know, in an equal way about themselves and who they are and why things work the way they do. It's such a peculiar world we live in, you know.
Yeah, I put up a post recently on Facebook where I enjoy talking about these things, and I said I made a point about you know, that was a point that was right out of your book, that, you know, President Obama would not have accomplished the kind of hope and change that he ran on even without Republican obstructionism. And the liberal diehards chimed in and said, oh no, you're so wrong, you don't get it. Everything Obama would have done so much more if it weren't for the Republicans. There's always this knee jerk, we must blame the Republicans for everything. There's never the sense that, no, you know what, we did that. Or we wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's the thing about Obama. It's you know, we put so much. I'm speaking for myself here, but I think a lot of people probably shared, you know, my point of view on him, which was in 2008. I had, you know, I was so emotionally committed to him, you know, to the hope and the change and all that stuff. And it's. It's like we're weighed down by that, you know. We can't acknowledge that it didn't work out the way we wanted it to. That's too much to ask of people, and so they have to come up with you know, all of these ways of. People want to believe basically that Obama was a, you know, one of the greatest presidents. They want to believe that, and so they basically his biggest fans now go out there and argue that in fact, you know, the president. Presidency is not a very powerful job. All these things to get him off the hook. It's like our whole idea of history has to be distorted in order for our hope to still be pure. You know, the feelings that we had in 2008, in order for those to still be intact, we have to believe all this other stuff.
Yeah, it is amazing. So let's get into this book. What I love so much personally, what I enjoy so much about this book, it's the same reason I enjoy works by Rick Perlstein. It's really in-depth political history. It goes into beyond the headlines, into the history. This is where this idea came from, and this is when this started. And it's so fascinating. It goes back many decades and looks at how the modern Democratic Party came into being and evolved out of the real progressive movements and of the 60s and 70s. And you write, I think the best place to start is with maybe 1971. Let's just grab a date out of the last few decades to sort of hang our beginning on here. 1971, of course, is the infamous year, or the year of the infamous Powell memo. I'm going to ask you to tell people about the Powell memo, which was secretive, but then, as you write, the very same year, there was a kind of Powell memo for the left that was not secret at all. It was Fred Dutton's book, Changing Sources of Power. Tell us about 1971, the Powell memo, and Dutton's book, and put those in the context of what was going to unfold over the next few decades.
Well, this was the big change, you know. Well, when I was studying history, we used to say the big change, meaning, you know, the 30s. But the big change of our time is, of course, the 60s and the 70s. And the Powell memo, as a lot of your listeners probably know, was written by Lewis Powell, later a Supreme Court justice, but was a confidant of President Nixon. And basically, it was the plan for the revival of the conservative movement. He sort of sketched it all out in a secret memo that he sent around to a small number of his colleagues. And a lot of people have really latched onto this and described it at length and see it as a blueprint for the entire conservative movement ever since. What fascinates me, though, in Listen Liberal, was this, the Powell memo of the Democrats, which was not secret. It wasn't just circulated to a few people. It was written. It was a book. I don't think it was a bestseller, but it was it was a popular book. You can get a paperback of it easily on Amazon, for a penny or whatever, And it's called Changing Sources of Power. It's written by Frederick Dutton, who was a Democratic power broker. He was a right-hand man to Bobby Kennedy, among other things. He later became a lobbyist, I believe, for Saudi Arabia. He was a DC player.
Yeah.
Put it that way. And but in 1970, he in the early 70s, he served on something called the McGovern Commission, which the Democrats set up after the debacle of 1968. They set up a commission to reform their party and to change the way they chose their presidential candidates. And this is where we get the primary elections from. Before then, there were very few primary elections, and then after the McGovern Commission, basically that's the system that we use, both parties now, in order to choose the president, or to choose our presidential candidates, I should say. And when the Democrats did this, it was a good idea for all sorts of reasons, and the stuff that they did was very populist, and it opened up the party in all sorts of ways, very healthy, as we're seeing this year. But it also did it did some other structural things which are not so healthy. And one of them is they basically removed organized labor from its structural position within the Democratic Party. And at the time, this probably seemed like not a bad idea. Organized labor was it was like a dinosaur. It was very slow moving. It tended to be very conservative. It was very white. A lot of the unions weren't very democratic, so it kind of made, and most importantly, a lot of unions had been on the wrong side of the Vietnam War issue, and that was really the tipping point. That's where everything changed back in those days. So so the McGovern Commission did what it did, and we can understand why they did what they did. What they didn't see happening, of course, was that once you remove, the sort of structural voice or structural power of working people's organizations, you also remove working people's issues from your party. And that didn't become manifest for a long time.
And this was a recommendation that was explicit in Dutton's book in 71.
Yes, explicit, yeah. Yes. He says basically the legatees of the New Deal, the people who benefited from the New Deal, we have to basically, they're now they're against us. They're on the wrong side of history, and we have to, the Democratic Party has to find new constituencies. And the main new constituency that he was really excited about was, yeah, it makes me almost sick to talk about this stuff, but it was the counterculture. It was enlightened, college-educated young people. It was the professional class, the rising white-collar, affluent professional class. These people were supposed to be so enlightened, and everybody could see that blue-collar people were, reactionary fools, and, the Democrats had to reorganize themselves as a party of, dominated by, led by professionals. and this is very much in keeping with the kind of, you know, can I take a step back here, Corey?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
When I was younger, my first book, which I don't know if anybody's read any, my first book is about the 60s and about the way the counterculture was received and understood by establishment culture, and particularly by the advertising industry. This is my book. It was called The Conquest of Cool, that I wrote a long time ago. And one thing I learned when I wrote that was that there is, you know, a lot of real establishment types in this country saw in the counterculture and like the, you know, the kids at the fancy colleges, you know, who cared so much about everything. They didn't see this as a threat. They saw this as a kind of, you know, a millennial thing. They thought this was absolutely wonderful. You know, they thought this was this sort of advent of, well, it's the, you know, it's the age of Aquarius.
Right.
You
right.
know,
and
some of the people that fell for this the most were these establishment types, so like Frederick Dutton. And this book, becoming, you know, Changing Sources of Power, is absolutely filled with this kind of credulity about youth culture that's almost embarrassing to read. But here's the screwy thing. This guy was one of the players on the McGovern Commission. He was one of the ones who made this choice to, you know, forget about organized labor and choose this other group instead.
And so in 1970...
You know, enlightened young professionals.
Yeah. So in 1972, with the McGovern Commission, 1 year after his book, he's at the table making this decision, and we see in that year this very explicit conscious decision on the part of the Democratic Party to abandon the FDR party, the working class, and embrace the baby boomers, and to basically yeah. give the party over to the boomers.
Yes, but let's just so your listeners aren't confused, when people in this era talked about the baby boomers, they didn't mean baby boomers who served in Vietnam. They didn't mean baby boomers who worked on an assembly line. They meant baby boomers who went to fancy colleges. By the way, they also didn't mean baby boomers who went to community college. They meant baby boomers who were at the, you know, at
yeah,
the sort
it's a
of
great point. It's a great
schools.
Point. So it's not a generational thing. It's a class thing.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. we say it's a generation thing, but in fact, it was a class thing. Generations and classes are often confused in American
yeah.
life, and this was a period when that was at its worst. But yeah, that is what happened in the early 70s, and they were explicitly saying we have to turn away from the New Deal, and this went on for years and years and years, all through the 70s, all through the 80s. All through the 90s, all of these Democratic Party thinkers, you know, who write for the Democratic Party magazines and who run for office, all of them were saying that we all know what the answer to the Democrats' problems are, and it's always the same thing. They have to turn away from the New Deal. And there's all these different factions in the Democratic Party in those days, and they fought over all sorts of different things. Like McGovern's faction was called the New Politics, you know, group. There's another faction called the Democratic Leadership Council, which was a very conservative group. And there's another one called the Neoliberals. But all of these groups, and they disagreed on all sorts of things, but they all agreed that the New Deal was over, the New Deal had to end, and that Democrats had to turn away from working people and had to become the party of affluent, white-collar professionals.
We're talking with
best-selling... They said this openly. This is not a secret.
Best-selling author Tom Frank is with us. The book is Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And that's what we're finding out right now. What did happen to the Party of the People? You mentioned the DLC, 1985, white Southern Democrats step forward, form this group. And a future popular president comes out of that group, does he not? And you can connect these ideological. I know you do too. I love connecting these dots and this ideological lineage from Bill Clinton and the DLC and the McGovern Commission. It's just so fascinating. Tell us Bill Clinton's story and how he comes out of the DLC and finally realizes the dreams of the McGovern Commission of 72.
Yeah, well, so Clinton is as you just said, he was the leader of the Democratic Leadership Council, or he was more of a figurehead for the Democratic Leadership Council, and he was a sort of star guy, and he ran for, you know, his primary campaign was basically the Democratic Leadership Council was who helped him out. So he was a product of this group of conservative Democrats, but he also had a foot in the other camp, in the McGovern camp, and he was a baby boomer who went to these fancy colleges. You know, he went to Georgetown and Yale Law School. He was a Rhodes Scholar. And if you read, you know, the sort of the biographies of Bill Clinton, that the ones where they where the biographer really likes him, they will often describe him as a leader of his generation, of the, you know, the baby boom generation. So he's sort of, he embodies all of the different strains that I'm describing, the baby boomer worship, the McGovern new politics type, and the Democratic Leadership Council.
Yeah.
All of them are brought together in his you know, in his person.
It is,
and
yeah.
He becomes president.
He's that part of the
93.
He's the part of that Venn diagram right in the middle where all the circles interconnect.
Yeah, with him.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, I guess Hillary too. You know, she's there as well. I mean, this is a woman who, I mean, think about it. Started out her career working for the what's the name of the group? The Children's Defense Fund or whatever.
Children's Legal Defense Fund.
Also working for McGovern, and then on the board of Walmart. You know, these are people who are in who bridge these different worlds without any problem. You know.
And that's one of the takeaways from your book, is to really sort of pull back the layers of the very concept of this professional class that came out of the 70s as this rising generation, and really understand who they are. And they are not,
yeah,
they are not people who represent the interests of working class voters and even the middle class.
That's right. Well, they don't represent those voters, and they also they really don't care about those voters. I mean, they will say that they do, you know. And Bill Clinton, you know, if you read the sort of official versions of his presidency or his own account of his presidency, he'll always say that he's the great, you know, friend of working America or something. You know, they always say stuff like that. But in point of fact, so what I did to study the Clinton years is I read books by his admirers. I didn't read any of the kind of right-wing hate literature about Bill Clinton, which is, by the way, all coming back now. Donald Trump is bringing it all back up, all the right-wing hate stuff about him. So
yeah.
I didn't mess with any of that. I didn't go into his affairs, you know, except for Monica Lewinsky does come up in a kind of critical moment, a critical juncture of his presidency. But other than that, I didn't go into any of that stuff. I only read the favorable accounts of him. Or the you know, the responsible biographies of him, and I used that to construct my account of his presidency and what he actually did as president. So, you know, if you put all that sort of crazy stuff aside, you know, the conspiracy theories about him, and ask what he actually did, it's actually not a very pretty picture. You know, we remember the 90s as good times because towards the end of the 90s, the economy was just going like crazy, you know, and job growth was out of control. Wages actually went up for the first, well, just about the only time in a lot of people's memories. I mean, certainly in my memory, that was the only really sustained good times we've had. And so people often look back at Bill Clinton with great fondness. But if you look at the things he actually did, all of them are terrible. Every single one of them has yielded disaster. Do you want me to go over what they are?
Yeah, let's do that. And then, because that really is the, and just to sort of underscore what you've been saying, this book really looks in depth at the policy decisions that came as a result of that sea change in the 70s in the Democratic Party, and then into the 80s. What were the policy results and politics, but what were they doing when they got into power? And you know, to cut to the chase, they were doing what Republicans did.
It was similar to what Republicans did, but it's the argument about the professional class is actually really fascinating because it's more than just that this is the Democrats' number one constituency. It was, of course, and this is the group that they do everything in their power to help. This is a group that does very well when Democrats are in office. But Democrats also produce this literature arguing that the professional class is the sort of chosen class of history, that they are, you know, like how Marxists would do with the proletariat is what they sort of do with the professional class. These are the people. All everything in history points their way. They stand at the very, you know, the telos of history. You know, they are the winners. And so the Democratic Party deliberately and consciously remakes itself as a party of winners, of the sort of winners of post-industrial society.
And Tom, before you talk about Tom, before you talk about Clinton's policies in the 90s, and we'll
very easy for me to get sidetracked.
And that's totally fine.
You got to look out for that.
That's how you. That's how you and I talk about these things. It's so much fun. But I also want to throw in a tangent here about exactly what you're talking about. This idea that the Democrats, the party, really was taken over by this professional class, and it became their whole purpose of being, and it was the fulfillment of, you know, they saw themselves as history has led up to this point. And I found in that whole idea, really, it's the new version of the 18th century elite, who, you know, the Jefferson, the Washington, the Hamiltons, the Madisons, who absolutely saw themselves in the very same way. Adam Smith wrote about them. Aristotle wrote about this, that this there will be in society an elite, educated class who has more leisure than somebody who's working for a living, quote-unquote, and it is their, not responsibility, it is their due to lead government, to be in power. And it's a, of course, it's a circular, self-serving
yes,
way of thinking.
But you, that's a really important point there. And the thing is that with a guy like Jefferson, at least, Jefferson, there's some recognition that this is also a this is not a democratic way of doing things, you know. So that is absolutely correct, and this goes way back in the history of America. But it's that was a time also that was swept away in the Jacksonian period when they decided that being ruled by an elite is not democratic,
right? Exactly.
You know, we don't want to do that anymore, and that was the end of, you know, like the Federalists and all of these people, and now it's back. Anyhow, I'm sorry.
And arguably,
just
to continue that thread and pull it through, arguably it came back in the 20s. I mean, in public opinion in 1922 with Walter Lippmann, you see this argument that the experts should be the one to run government. And you sort of see this, the seeds being planted of what would become what you call in your book the professional class. You see Lippmann talking about this, these people with these young men with impressive degrees who went to the good schools and they're smart and they're experts. You have the City Manager book, 1927 by Leonard White, where he argues that, you know, the whole world is embracing this idea of government by experts. And and that sort of lays the groundwork. We see Democrats thinking even in the 20s that the future power of the world will be with the very educated, the person with the most degrees behind their name, and this class of experts who will take over. And the Democrats finally did that in the 90s with Bill Clinton.
Yes, they did. So that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book. I mean, to be very frank with you, and that is my name, so I'm allowed to say that. Look, so when Barack Obama came in 2009, one of the reasons that I was so excited about him was that we had just been through this administration of hacks and cronies, you know, the Bush people with the, you know, like, remember Michael Brown at FEMA?
Yeah, of course.
After Hurricane Katrina, what a disaster this guy was.
It was the very antithesis of the idea of government by experts.
Yeah, and so I was very excited because, you know, Barack Obama, one thing we knew about him is that he would bring in talented people to run everything. And it was this terrible stock market crash and the bailouts of Wall Street was underway. And, I wanted to have government by intelligent people. I was excited about that. I was enthusiastic about that. And look what happened. I mean, nothing changed. The, you know, on the important matter, the most important matter of what to do about Wall Street, essentially nothing changed. Having, you know, the smartest people in the country rather than a collection of hacks and cronies turned out to mean the same thing. And that was shocking to me. And that's sort of the genesis of this book. And I asked myself when I, you know, there's another antecedent here that you didn't mention, which is a famous book written again in the 70s called The Best and the Brightest. And it's about the Vietnam War.
Yeah,
and
of course.
About how the sort of international relations and political science professions got us into the Vietnam War and kept us in there when all the evidence said this is a bad idea. They, you know, they managed to overlook that and just kept going. And it was, you know, this catastrophe brought to you again by meritocracy. And so I said to myself, well, gee whiz, has there ever been a time when meritocracy worked, you know, when government by expert actually worked? Because this is something that seems like a good idea to me. How come it always fails? And I thought about this, and there is a period. It is actually really interesting. There is a period when it worked, and it was the Franklin Roosevelt administration.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's worked a lot of times, but it worked resoundingly well in the Franklin Roosevelt administration, where he, you know, he had his famous brain trust, and they, you know, they were... They were heroes, and they didn't do everything right, but they did a lot of things. They did, I mean, come on, they got us out of the Depression. They won World War II. It was a great time. It was when government actually worked. But I tell you, Coy, so when you compare the cabinet of the Barack Obama's inner circle of advisors, or Bill Clinton's inner circle of advisors, or Hillary's inner circle of advisors to the Roosevelt administration, you notice something shocking right away, which is nowadays it's the advisors of these people are always drawn from, as you said, this very small number of elite colleges and elite graduate schools, elite programs. It's a very small number of places. You look at, you know, it's always Harvard, you know that. Or with Obama, it's always these, you know, guys from Oxford, Rhodes Scholars. And it's very concentrated. It's just a handful of institutions, of schools that he draws all of his advisors from. You look at Roosevelt. Roosevelt was a Harvard man. So is Obama. But Roosevelt took his advisors from all over the country, from all different walks of life. They were highly intelligent people, but they had come from all sorts of different experiences. Small-town bankers. He had a lot of really interesting people working for him, but one of the best is this guy Mariner Eccles, who ran the Federal Reserve, was a small-town banker from Utah. I love that. He's not some Harvard guy. He's a small-town banker from Utah. Or his attorney general, Robert Jackson, was a lawyer with no law degree. This is a guy that was the prosecutor at Nuremberg. Later, they put him on the Supreme Court. Harry Truman was the last U.S. president that didn't – he was Roosevelt's VP – didn't go to college. You know, you go right down the list. Harry Hopkins, his Roosevelt's right-hand man during World War II, was a social worker from Iowa. You know, Henry Wallace, also from Iowa, edited a magazine for farmers. You know, it's these people with very, very different life experiences. And Roosevelt, he did have a lot of Ivy Leaguers working for him, but even they were a different sort of species of Ivy Leaguer than what you see in Washington today. There are people like John Kenneth Galbraith, right, who was in the Office of Price Administration during World War II. And this is a guy who spent his entire life fighting against what he called the conventional wisdom, you know, which is absolutely the opposite
of the way Washington of where we are now.
Today.
Yeah.
I mean, conventional is where we are. You know, that's today when you hire all these Harvard guys and all these people at the very top, you know, from these very top schools, what you're getting is orthodoxy. And that's the problem. And this is, the professional class never understands this, that they are actually servants of orthodoxy. The people who are at the top of the profession aren't necessarily the best. They're the ones who have, you know, reiterated the catchphrases most ably or whatever it is. They're not the best. They're the most orthodox.
And if I'm sitting in a boardroom on Wall Street, that's what I want in Washington. I want orthodoxy. I want the same regardless of party. Because it makes it easier to place my bets. Right?
Ouch.
We're talking with Tom Frank. The book is Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Tom, stay with me. We'll take a very quick break, and there's more when we get back. This is Inside Charlottesville. My guest is Tom Frank, best-selling and celebrated author. His latest book is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Tom, you like how I threw in the little voice accent there on the title, Listen, Liberal? Because every time I see it, that's what I'm thinking you're saying. Like, hey, listen up.
That's exactly right. Listen up, liberal.
Yeah.
You have to say it in this kind of Kansas voice. there's a C. Wright Mills title called Listen, Yankee, that I was kind of hoping to... I was sort of hoping to emulate that. There's a couple of C. Wright Mills references in the book, the sociologist from the 1950s. I guess the last sort of celebrity sociologist, maybe the only celebrity sociologist we've ever had in this country.
So let's look at the 90s. This professional class that comes out of the Democratic Party takes over in the 70s and 80s. They get their first president in Bill Clinton, and yet we don't see policies that benefit the working class. We see policies see policies that make it possible to destroy the middle class.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you can summarize the Bill Clinton years with, he had five main accomplishments. And by the way, these are things that his admirers like about him. This is what they used to point to when they'd say why he's a great president. And it's NAFTA, remember, North American Free Trade Agreement. And then he had a whole bunch of other free trade agreements afterwards. But that was the first one. That was the big fight. That was the landmark. So you have NAFTA, the crime bill of 94, welfare reform, bank and telecom deregulation, and then the balanced budget. And every single one of those was a Republican issue that he took over and made his own. And every single one of those ended in disaster. All of them have just been, brought ruin to this country. You know, you look at NAFTA. None of the things they were saying it would increase our exports. It would help out our trade deficit. It would increase American manufacturing and employment. It did exactly the opposite. We have this enormous trade deficit with Mexico now, and employers routinely use NAFTA as a threat with their workers, with their workforce. If they complain in the slightest, if they threaten to organize, if they are organized and demand better wages or something like that, it gave these people this, weapon to use at any time. We're going to move the plant, they say. They always, and this is very common, they say it all the time. Sometimes they even do it. You look at the crime bill. Well, everybody has been talking about that. It's been this complete sea change in the way we understand that. I was angry about it at the time, and now I've discovered the whole country is all upset about it. Or you look at welfare reform. Now this is on the front pages. I saw a story in the New York Times about this just the other day. People are starting to say, it was not really a good idea to end this this program that we inherited from the days of the New Deal. And then at the same time, so all of these things you've noticed, these are about disciplining or punishing poor and working class people, NAFTA, the crime bill, welfare reform. All of these things are about that. Then look at the other thing, bank deregulation. It's about, while at the very same moment we're cracking down on low-level drug users and we're throwing the poor off of welfare and we're, busting unions, or giving management sort of ultimate power over workers, while we're doing all these things, at the same time, the Clinton administration is literally rolling back the rules for Wall Street. Repealing all the old laws that used to bind them. And, so money becomes, money is liberated at the same moment as everybody else gets to learn discipline. It's crazy, but that's the Clinton. It's not crazy. It makes sense. That's Clintonism. That's what it's all about. One class of Americans is treated one way. Everybody else is treated a different way. One class gets this kind of heaven on earth, you know, this kind of good times like they have never seen before, like no one has ever seen before, and everybody else gets the whip hand, you know. And that's who we were then, and that's the way Democrats rule nowadays. They legislate to benefit one group and to punish other groups, and the groups that are punished tend to be working people and the poor.
Let me pull the camera way back here, Tom, and just throw out a thesis and see if you agree with it. In a very real sense, Clinton's new Democrats, quote unquote, which, you know, comes out of the decisions made by Democrats in the 70s, we need to change. You get these new Democrats, which take over in the 90s. They become, in a very real sense, what the GOP used to be in this country, while the GOP, thanks to Goldwater and Reagan and movement conservatism, they moved further to the right and made the GOP something else entirely. What, what Chris Hedges says, you know, a slow motion corporate coup d'etat, very much of a counter revolution against the progressive movements of the 60s and 70s. The entire political spectrum shifts to the right and abandons the 99% of the American people who no longer feel like, wait a minute, this whole system doesn't serve me anymore. In fact, it punishes me.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, that's a little overdrawn. I would say, the thing is that the Republicans keep pulling to the right. You know, they keep moving to the right. As we know, you know, Bill Clinton gave them concession after concession after concession. You know, he got NAFTA passed. That was one of their big ideas. He got welfare reform passed, another one of their big proposals. You know, he got bank deregulation done. Republicans had had a lot of trouble getting that done. You know, Reagan had had all sorts of problems. He wanted to get bank deregulation done, but he couldn't. It was Clinton that did it. All of these, you know, but as he's doing these things, the Republican Party itself pulls further and further, you know, it's always moving the goalposts further and further to the right, because that's how they play the game. And so what you find is that a lot of the constituencies in this country are motivated by a sort of really awful emotions, right? Fear of the Republicans for people like me. You know, that's what's, and this is being ramped up again right now. We're going to have an election where it's all about your fear and hate of Donald Trump, or alternately for the Republicans, this sort of, you know, sort of crazy fears about the Democrats that I've been writing about all these years. You know, these sort of conspiracy theories that they're forever dreaming up about who the Democrats are. So we're all motivated by fear and hate of one another, and look at the policies that get passed in the meantime. You know, it's these are terrible things. But there's one place where I would correct what you're saying. It's not the 99% versus the 1%. It's the top 10%. Okay, the profession. Whenever you try to understand why inequality, you know, it keeps galloping along. And the President Obama, you know, who's been so eloquent on the subject, just throws up his hands. Nothing he can do about it. Well, why is that? Well, part of it is because there is a constituency for inequality. There are people who really like it. And it's not just the top, you know, the 0.01% or something like that. It's about the top 10% of the population has done very well. The reason this is not comfortable for people to talk about and not comfortable for people to even admit is because those people are Democrats, that top 10%. This is the professional class. They have done extremely well, in the age of inequality. These are the people in the McMansions and this kind of thing. And they like inequality. It served them splendidly. They have no interest in changing it or reversing course.
So now we can go back to 71 and 72 in the decisions that were coming out of the Democratic Party then. How do we win elections and how do we get back in power? You can see coming out of those decisions, fast forward a few decades, and we're in a really scary place. Our politics are fueled by hate and fear. We see a runaway inequality that history is not shy about telling us, that this kind of inequality directly leads to massive social unrest or a police state or both.
Hey, it's here. I mean, look around. This election, we are 8 years after how long are we after? The recovery was in 2009. We're 7 years after the recovery. And for something like 70% of the American population, when you in polls, say that we're still in a recession. I mean, so in Listen Liberal, I visit some of these places that are never going to come back, like Fall River, Massachusetts, or Decatur, Illinois. Decatur is particularly important to me because this is where one of the first pieces of journalism I ever wrote was about a strike in Decatur, Illinois, back in the Clinton era, and I went back there to see what it looks like now, and it's not pretty. I mean, for people like that, this country is coming apart. I mean, they know their middle class lives that, like these blue collar guys in Decatur used to have in the 90s, that's gone. You know, they still have it because they were members of a union and they have a pension and they have a retirement. Their kids don't have it. Their kids got no chance at it. They've lost it. And it's horrifying. And this is happening all over this country. The middle class is coming apart. Inequality is growing worse. It's not a coincidence that, you know, Trump is echoing Sanders on all of these issues. This phrase that Elizabeth Warren dreamed up, you know, the economy is rigged. Everybody is saying it now. And, it's just going to get worse. I mean, I think Hillary Clinton is probably going to be elected president, and I don't think anything is going to change. It's going to be like Obama's third term. Nothing is going to change. Inequality is going to grow worse and worse and worse. And this situation is, the things that we dread, they're here.
And so, you know, when you and I talk about this stuff, I always go back to France. You know, I mean, that's our fate if we don't figure out soon enough our fate, like any country in human history that reaches this point. Your fate could be what happened to France in the 1790s. And to say that it was horrible, it's an understatement. I mean, they called it the Reign of Terror. I mean, it was just unspeakable. Yep. when the masses of people had enough. They had absolutely had enough. Yep. They were so fed up and they wanted change. And you see that anger at a Trump rally, and it's palpable at a Sanders rally.
Yep, it's frightening. Look, I'm a big fan of Bernie Sanders, and I voted for him here in Maryland, and what's fascinating about him is he is a throwback to the pre-1970s Democratic Party. This is a guy, he really admires Franklin Roosevelt. The New Deal is obviously the model for all of the social programs he's proposing. And the Democrats recoil from him as they would from something toxic. The party is so, I mean, like the office holders, the official sort of establishment Democratic Party hates this guy. And it's funny because he represents them. He represents what they used to be. It is fascinating. Yeah. By the way, I wonder what you think about, we haven't talked for a while, and speaking of Democratic heroes, Jefferson and Hamilton. Man, boy, what's going on? Hamilton is now this, like, superstar.
But in an age when the Democratic Party turns its back on the working class and becomes the new GOP, that's totally predictable.
I was wondering if you were going to say that. Yeah. That Hamilton, everybody would suddenly discover how sexy and cool Alexander Hamilton.
If only they knew. If only they really knew what he was all about. It's frightening. It's frightening. So Tom, how does this play out? I mean, really, it's just Trump's not going to go away. Trump has obviously shown the party regulars in the GOP, hey, this is your base now. This is where your base is now. They're with me, and we're not with you. And there is this really dangerous anger out there. And you know what? Neither you nor I would dismiss it. They're right to be angry.
Yep, they are. They are. Their anger is, I mean, he's leading them in all sorts of, like, I think really dangerous and frightening directions. But he also says things that are obviously true, that ring true for a lot of these people when he talks about trade and stuff like that, the trade deals. He does it in a kind of a blunt and stupid way. But, at the end of the day, he's right about the trade deals. And, you know what gets me is watching how the Democrats and how liberals in general deal with this. It's sort of a, you know, and it's by wagging their finger at these people and scolding these
right.
people.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, as though that's the answer.
Yeah, yeah, like that's going to do anything.
You know, what's crazy is you think of how someone like Lyndon Johnson would have just made, like, really short work of Donald Trump, you know? And this is just getting scarier and scarier by the minute, because instead we don't have Lyndon Johnson. We don't have Franklin Roosevelt. We don't have John F. Kennedy. We don't have Thomas Jefferson. We have Hillary Clinton. And she is precisely the kind of, I mean, an intelligent person, a well-meaning person, but classic sort of exemplar of the professional class. You know, she is a technocrat.
Yeah,
she
and more
everything with the, she'll bring in the experts and they'll run the programs yeah. in exactly the right way. And don't you know that having experts run things is better than having non-experts? And besides, and how come people are so upset about the economy? Can't they see that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is way up high? You know, and it's scolding.
Yeah.
Scolding these voters, you know, and that is, you know, if the Democrats didn't have such a lopsided demographic advantage, this is like Dukakis all over again. It's so bad.
It's Shay's Rebellion all over again. It's the Adams, what was Adams' wife? John Adams' wife. It's her in her letter to Jefferson where she's just, oh, these Shays people, you know, in Massachusetts, they were scolding them then. The people, they just don't understand. They don't get it. Things are good. Yeah, and they're going broke and they're losing their farm and they're going hungry and their kids have no future. And but it's just amazing. And Hillary Clinton, obviously, or arguably much more conservative than her husband was.
Yep. That's right. You're talking about John Adams and his wife?
Yes, exactly. Saying? Yeah, that's what I was, yeah.
Yeah, that is a very interesting comparison. I had not thought of that.
Well, they exactly scold them, right. You know, Shays Rebellion.
Exactly right. And, and Jefferson, of course, you know, was determined to destroy the Federalist Party.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they scold them. They scold the people in 1787 with Shays Rebellion in the same way that Hillary Clinton scolds the Republicans and scolds the liberals who you know, are saying, hey, wait a minute, you don't represent yeah. me. But then you fast forward just a few years to the Whiskey Rebellion, and you have Washington and Hamilton taking an army of 11,000 men into western Pennsylvania, which was an army bigger than the one they won the revolution with, to take that army against American citizens who wouldn't buy into Hamilton and Washington's counter-revolutionary economic schemes to put government in business with business to benefit an elite financial class. The people knew what was going on. They weren't stupid, and they were standing up against it, and they weren't scolding him anymore. They were using what was the first police state in America, which was that army going into western Pennsylvania. And
that is depressing. Thanks, yeah. Boy. You put me in a good mood there. I mean, that's something we sort of want to avoid. You know, that's funny. People never talk about that anymore. That's never a historical comparison. But geez, you've done it now. Now I'm going to go dig out the old history books and read up on that.
Tom Frank, the latest book, must read new book. It is absolutely one that you will not want to miss. I promise you. Is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Tom, we have a few minutes left, and I have to ask you about education, because you write so much about it in your book as this fallback, go-to agenda item for the new Democratic Party, for these new Democrats since the 70s, that no matter how bad the world is falling apart, they always stand up and look into the camera and say, the solution is education. You gotta be one of us. You gotta go to a good school. You wanna be one of us. You gotta get an education. And my question for you is, and this is in light of the work of economist Michael Hudson, who writes about the FIRE economy, finance, insurance, and real estate.
Yes.
What happens when education becomes part of the problem? when you look at
we're there. That's happened. That has come to pass. Look, before I say anything else, I'm a great believer in education. I went to UVA. I spent 25 years of my life getting an education. I went out and got a PhD. However, you know, all that said, when Democrats look at any economic problem, they see an education problem. always. You know, whatever you name the problem, whatever is going on, they're like, well, you know, the answer is we just need to get more people with STEM degrees, or we need to get fewer people with STEM degrees. We need people to study other things. Whatever it is, we need more people to have to go to college. It's just a way of brushing the problem off. It's a way of blaming the problem on the individual. So the problem is not the failure of the economy, or the loss of power by workers, or the destruction of organized labor, any of those things. The problem is you and your failure to go out and get, you know, a bachelor's degree or a master's degree or a PhD. You know, that's the problem, that you didn't study hard enough, and that's why you're failing. So it's meritocracy. The meritocracy really is not a solution to inequality. Meritocracy is a way of excusing inequality. You know, it's a way of rationalizing inequality. But then, I mean, I also take on the idea of education in all sorts of very, very particular ways. You know, it comes up again and again and again. I mean, when you suggested that one of these days education is going to become a part of the problem, and I said it already is, it's because of it's now become so expensive, right? All our presidents for the last however many years have been telling everybody that they have to get a college degree. All our high school principals are telling us that. All our guidance counselors, all our parents, everybody knows you have to get a college degree. So what do the colleges do? They jack up the price of tuition, you know, so it's super duper high. So the place I went to graduate school, Coy, is now $60,000 a year.
Jeez.
To go. Yeah, seriously.
Oh my God.
But if you went to that for 4 years, that's almost $250,000. And nobody has that kind of money.
For no job.
Not even the 1%. Nobody has that kind of money lying around. Okay, maybe the 1%. But it's that's where we're at. And so you go get a college degree, and heaven forbid you go out and get a PhD, and you take out student loans to do it. You're going to be starting life with the equivalent of a mortgage hanging over your head, and no house to sell, right? You're just in debt for the rest of your life, and you've got nothing to show for it, except for that you read a bunch of books and you got to eat in the fancy cafeteria for 4 years.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it makes me so angry. And, you know, starting out life with this kind of debt is not a good thing. So there's a study of, I mean, I'm going to mess up the statistics here Oh, it doesn't matter. I can't even do the statistics. They're all in Listen Liberal. You can find them all in there. But people with a college degree in certain demographics, people with a college degree came out of the Great Recession worse than people who didn't have a college degree. And the reason is because they borrowed. You know, they did everything right.
Yep.
They did everything like President Obama tells them to do. And look what's happened to them.
Their wealth
has been destroyed.
Tom, it makes perfect sense. If you really accept the fact that America is not, as Michael Hudson writes, this is not a consumption production economy anymore. It's an economy that relies on the manufacturing of debt, because debt service, if everybody's paying their money towards debt, that's going to end up benefiting a very small fraction of the population versus the kind of economy you read about in high school, where people make things and then they buy things. But if everybody's paying on debt, that's where you ensure the financial success of an oligarch class, of an elite class. So America, now both parties have accepted this notion that America is our great manufacturing product is debt. That's what we make. And now they've lassoed education into that very same formula. So college kids leave with hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in debt. They can't get the new house. They can't get the washer and dryer. They can't buy the new car. They're lucky if they find a job to even pay their bills. And again, we come right back to this point that foments social unrest. That's where
Can I just throw one thing in there?
Yeah.
We are the heirs of Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what he wanted, remember?
This is what he wanted.
He wanted debt. He wanted federal debt, and then he wanted bondholders. He wanted it attached to it. But the economy, the country was going to be based on debt.
Absolutely.
It was kind of a genius idea at the time.
Right, right.
I don't know if I like it any longer, though.
Tom, I want to try to end on a positive note, and I'm going to read you an excerpt from Listen Liberal, and I just want you to respond to it. You write at the very end of Chapter 10, you write, "In truth, we have been hearing some version of all of this
Inno talks since the 1970s, a snarling Republican iteration which demands our submission before the almighty entrepreneur, and a friendly and caring Democratic one which promises to patch us up with job training and student loans. What each version brushes under the rug is that it doesn't have to be this way. Economies aren't ecosystems. They aren't naturally occurring phenomena to which we must learn to acclimate. Their rules are made by humans. They are, in a word, political. In a democracy, we can set the economic table however we choose. Our fate is not sealed, Tom Frank. We do have the ability to create the kind of country we want, where money can benefit schools and, you know, the kind of vision that Bernie Sanders has, that we can, America governments take money from people. We do tax people. We have fees. We collect money. We can spend that money to benefit people, or we can give it to a small fraction of the citizenry and continue to make an oligarchic elite class even more wealthy. It's our decision.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I've been having a lot of sort of existential moments lately where I walk down the street and look at my fellow Americans and, these very smug, sort of contented, suburban, McMansion types, or these people that are really suffering. And every now and then it just dawns on me with, this sort of overpowering force, the fact that we could choose to do everything differently if we wanted, it's totally within our power. I mean, and I hope the day comes when we do choose to, change a few things pretty dramatically. But I don't know, Coy. I'm both very negative these days, as you heard earlier, but I'm also positive. The Bernie Sanders phenomenon has been very healthy in a lot of ways. But the Trump phenomenon is very frightening, and we're going to see how it plays out.
The book is Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Best-selling, award-winning, celebrated author Tom Frank, a graduate of Mr. Jefferson's University. Tom, it's always a thrill to talk to you, sir, and hopefully we can do this again soon. I'd really look forward to that.
Anytime, Coy. The pleasure's all mine.
I'll be in touch soon. Thank you so much.